Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. I'm Sam Howlett and this week we'll be discussing Mike Mills' 20th Century Women. Joining me today is Jenna.
Hi.
And Jake.
Hello.
Hello. This week we are also joined by the director of the film, Mike Mills, and that interview will be coming up in a bit. We also have a competition for you guys. So a question will be put up on social media sometime today, the answer to which will be something said in the show. So listen and pay attention, and then the question will be up later today, and you have the chance to win a vinyl copy of the soundtrack to the film, which is amazing. Very jealous. Wish I could win it. But first up, let's have a question. So the film is about a mother-son relationship. And, you know, in the past weeks, we've had a father-daughter relationship in Tony Erdmann and a sort of uncle-nephew relationship in Manchester by the Sea. So today, focusing on the mother and son, my question for you guys is, pitch me the perfect mother-son duo in a film. Let's start with Jake.
Okay, so I initially was looking, trying to think of, like, my favourite film mums, and then I kind of went down a sidetrack of that and failed to think about the sons. So I initially was thinking something with Emily Watson and Kelly MacDonald, because they're just great mums. You just think, who would you want as a mum? And they would be brilliant, but I couldn't quite find the right sons, and I was trying to picture some kind of competition where they were both trying to be the better mum. But in the end, I went for Amber Waves, who's Julianne Moore's character in Boogie Nights. Because she's very maternal in that film, and she's trying to branch away from the porn industry, and I kind of want maybe like a spin-off sequel from Boogie Nights that's just her, and having some kind of maternal filmmaker tutor relationship with someone played by Michael Barbieri, who is the New York kid from Little Men.
Nice.
Who's the drama guy.
Yeah.
I think because he's brilliant in that, and I think you pair him and his accent with Julianne Moore's Boston one as well. You could have these accents flying around as these two go around the country trying to get out of the porn industry and into real filmmaking. That's what I want.
I love it, Jake. Yeah.
Excellent. Jenna.
Okay, well, I started off my journey differently, thinking about the best film kids, which led me very quickly to Macaulay Culkin as Kevin McAllister in Home Alone. I just don't think you get to see enough of him. I mean, I know he's the main star of two films, but I want to see him in his teenage years. I love his pranks. I love his imagination.
I don't want to see what Macaulay Culkin is doing at home alone in his teenage years.
He doesn't have to be home alone then, because this is the beauty of my film. We then get Uma Thurman from Kill Bill as a bride, because she is also, you know, pretty feisty.
Yeah. And
to put it mildly, team them together and they don't even have to stay in the house. Well, they could. They could be like defending their home, or they could just go out to the streets together and pull pranks on bad guys.
Just hanging out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
don't think you're taking my film suggestion very seriously.
I'm sure Tarantino would be up for it.
Yeah, definitely.
I think Macaulay Culkin would be up for it
I think he would.
Tarantino's Home Alone would be incredibly violent.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'd like to see that. My choice is a remake of Psycho with Judi Dench as Mrs. Bates and Dwayne The Rock Johnson as Norman Bates.
Yeah. Oh, why has no one done that yet?
I know.
Shot for shot?
No, because it will expand on the relationship between Mrs. Bates and Norman Bates.
Okay.
But just imagine... You can imagine Judi Dench as Mrs. Bates being kind of, you know, scowling towards her son.
Mm.
But then you can also imagine Dwayne Johnson calling Judi Dench mother. Yeah. I'm sorry, mother. And what's that, mother?
And he's doing the accent.
Yeah. And inevitably, he'll have to wear Judi Dench's clothes by the end of the film. And I think that's something we'd all really enjoy.
This is no machinist. He's not going to be losing weight. This is full form Dwayne The Rock
Johnson.
Yeah,
yeah, sure. Yeah.
Just make it. So you've got to have a training montage in there as well to explain why Norman Bates is so huge.
I don't think I do. I think I trust audiences enough that they're happy to accept that Norman Bates is just a big guy in this new version.
That they'll watch the film and they'll see Judi Dench and they'll see Dwayne Johnson and you think, yes, that is mother and son right there.
Yeah.
And this can set up the whole Hitchcock cinematic universe of remakes.
Yeah.
All starring
Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
And Judi Dench.
Yeah, so sometimes they're mother and son, sometimes they're lovers.
North by Northwest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to see him taking on loads of Cary Grant roles.
Yeah, I think we'd all want to see that.
Yeah.
Him in The Birds, I think, would be great.
Yeah.
Vertigo, imagine him... I mean, when he leapings over the building, he'll just go straight through the ceiling.
Rear Window, I can really imagine.
Yeah.
He would be wonderful.
With Judi Dench as the Grace Kelly role.
100%. Yeah.
He'd just break through the cast.
Yeah.
Like he did in Fast and Furious 7. If no one's seen that, there's a bit where he's got his arm in a cast and he sees there's some bad guys and he literally says, Daddy's got to go to work, and just breaks through the cast. So he'd do the same thing, but in Rear Window. Okay. So yeah, Psycho remake, Dwayne Johnson, Judi Dench.
Wow. I'm impressed. I'd watch it.
Yeah.
Do we think that's the winner?
Yeah, I think that's got to
be.
That's the pitch for this week. We got to give that the money.
Excellent. That's the first time I've won.
Oh, well done, mate. Yeah,
I won when I wasn't here.
Yeah, that no one's beaten that.
Was that Adam and Deck?
Natalie Portman, Gareth Gates, wasn't it?
The Gareth Gates story.
I don't know what you were smoking when you came with that, Jen. So as I mentioned earlier, we have a special guest this week. I met up a few weeks ago to speak to the film's director, Mike Mills, and we had a chat. So here is that. Enjoy. Okay, so we're delighted to be joined now by 20th Century Women director, Mike Mills. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Yeah.
So I saw the film this morning.
Oh,
really enjoyed
wow.
it, really loved it.
Yeah.
So Beginners was obviously a very personal film for you.
Uh-huh.
So could you maybe tell us in what ways is 20th Century Women personal to you?
Well, it's... similarly, it's Annette Bening's character is based on my mom.
Okay.
And Greta Gerwig's character is based on my sister. And Elle Fanning's character is based on my first girlfriend and a bunch of women that I knew growing up. And I was kind of very much raised in a matriarchy, or raised by women who taught me what it means to be a man or a boy, or... and taught me sort of everything. So I was trying to write about that. But I write from a personal place to try to make the best movie I can. I'm not trying to make a memoir, I'm not trying to do therapy in public. I'm trying to sort of report from a close distance and try to say something unique and genuine and with love about being human, you know?
Okay.
And that's where it comes from.
Okay, excellent. So I guess in a way you've had two films now where you've had characters representing yourself.
Uh-huh.
So Ewan McGregor's character in Beginners, and here Jamie.
Yeah. Not as good looking as me. Sadly. Yeah.
So is that a weird kind of casting someone to be yourself? And what do you look for in someone when casting a version of yourself? Yeah.
You know, very handsome. well, to be honest, I'm kind of in denial that those people are me. And I don't like thinking about that. It just makes me uncomfortable, and I'm just sort of I'm duplicitous about it. Like, they are me, but I don't want to admit it. So, they're characters. as is my mother, as is my sister in this one, they're characters and they have certain qualities to them. So you kind of distance yourself. And I'm not trying to have anyone be me, mimic me, or anything like that. They just need to be able to inhabit the basic kind of person that this character is. So Jamie is sort of like, what's the word? He's more cerebral than physical. He's rough enough to be like a punk kid. He's rough enough to get in a fight, but he's not tough enough to win the fight.
Right, yeah.
So it's a specific kind of guy. He's wanting to have sex, but he hasn't had sex. And it's a specific point in his life. So I'm looking for that more than me, and I really don't... I'm just not comfortable thinking it's me. It makes me cringe.
You know? So I guess in that way, it's semi-autobiographical rather than full-on autobiographical.
Well, yeah.
It's and a even, refracted version of you.
Yeah, refracted or... denied. And then the thing I'm much more interested in these portraits of, like, my mom, you know.
Yeah.
And but even that, well, there's a lot of just straight up completely real things that happened to her, or her biography, or how she died, or she really wanted to be a pilot. She did smoke Salems and wore Birkenstocks. All these details in the film are really from her. All the same, when you make it into a film, you're making it into like a public document. You're making it into a public story, and you're hoping that the realness of your source and your concrete details and your love that's mixed in with that charge the story, like charge it up and make it kind of more grippy and contagious to people. But you're cinematizing it, you know? And like, I love Fellini, I love Amarcord, I love 8½. And those movies are obviously very personal, but they're cinema at the same time. And so I feel like there's kind of a history of doing this that I'm involved in.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, because many directors do this kind of the semi-autobiographical biographical film at some point in their career.
Yeah.
And you've done two in a row.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what you're kind of... I mean, I don't know how far down the line you're thinking of, like, your filmography, that it will be this kind of personal exploration of you.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't have to be me. What I do really like is real life. And things I observed, or memories, or events in people's lives that don't like fit nicely into typical film plot. They're kind of disruptive.
Mm.
And they just smell like life more than they smell like a movie.
Okay.
And I love that. Like, I love that as a viewer, as an audience member. So I want to keep doing that. But it doesn't have to be me. I could interview you about your life.
Yeah.
And what are the salient, important, disruptive, meaningful things that happened, and then try to piece together cinema from that. So I think it's like more of a journalist mentality.
Okay.
And trying to inject that into what I do, and I like that process.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned there that it's really a film about your mom in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it you saw in Annette Bening that made you think, this is the woman, this is the actress to be my mom?
Well, my mom is sort of a very funny trickster figure that was born in the 20s, grew up during the Depression, had a very anti-authoritarian streak to her, did not fit into the confines that were offered to women in the 30s and 40s, wanted to be a pilot in World War II, was a draftsperson before anybody was, was a very unusual mother, and if any sort of man in authority tried to tell her to do anything, she was definitely going to try to undermine or get around that, and with a great sense of humor. So Annette has that humor. Annette has that intelligence. Annette is a complicated, rich human being who I thought could inhabit all the paradoxes that a real person has, you know, and that my real mom had. And then Annette's like beautifully... I think she was 55 when I met her, like beautifully 55, you know, and just natural and real and gorgeous in that way. And I don't know what else. I find Annette, to me, Annette is like a real deliciously subversive creature. Her sense of humor and her intelligence, and that really suited the character.
Okay. So I guess in a sort of, I don't know if this is maybe a coincidence or something, but in Beginners, we had Christopher Plummer kind of making a return to the public limelight after being away for a few years from like public consciousness and winning the Oscar and everything. And here, in a slightly similar vein, Annette Bening, we haven't really seen her, you know, in this kind of lead full-on role for a while. Is that something you were thinking about during the film? That there's kind of this feeling that this is her, almost not quite a comeback, but a return to public eye?
Not at all. I mean, and Christopher was like in Last Station right before my movie.
Right, okay.
That got a lot of attention for him. I don't really see it that way.
Yeah.
I need an actor who's like 79. I need an actor who's 55. Yeah. And these are the actors I picked. That wasn't part of my process.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. One of these, sort of, I don't know if I'm paraphrasing a quote from your own film here, but the best thing I took from the film is, it doesn't take a man to raise a man. Is that a theme you think that's missing from these kind of coming-of-age films or from just films in general?
That's just very specific to my mom's character and to what was happening in my life, because I was raised by my mom and my older sisters. And my dad, perhaps because he was a closeted gay man, or perhaps just because he was born in the 20s, just wasn't like a super present father figure. So I was raised by a woman, handily.
Okay.
And my mom was just a very practical, can-do, depressionary kid.
Yeah.
And she would think like, well, what do I have?
Yeah.
You know, I would love to have a man. I would love to have the William character in the film be more important to my son. It's just not.
Yeah.
So what am I going to do with what I have? You women seem right. And to me, the movie isn't... As a coming-of-age movie, I don't feel like it's a very good movie. it's not really... The boy doesn't change. The boy doesn't transform. The boy shows us the women.
Okay.
The boy is the way that we see this like portrait of these three women. So I feel like it's much more of a meditation on these relationships and these women.
Okay. So, and as a film about a mother-son relationship, is there any kind of technique you use as a director to really sell the fact that this mother and son are a mother and son, like in the ways you write it, ways you rehearse it, ways you cast it?
I guess in the writing would be that I'm really writing about my mom and me. So it's coming from a very known lived experience.
Yeah.
And I really believe in that as a great source beginning spot to make something good, you know? And then in the rehearsal, we did all sorts of weird things to try to make the connective tissue between all my actors. And maybe one of the best things I did was we had to have a lot of dance parties. And I kind of believe in music as like a... music has magical, irrational powers. And dancing is embarrassing and wonderful. And it just kind of puts people together in a non-discursive, non-cerebral way.
Okay. This film has some amazing like, non-choreographed dance scenes.
Mm-hmm.
How fun was filming then, and how tempted were you to just jump in there with them?
When we were rehearsing, I would dance. Because I feel like the actors are only going to go as far as the director goes.
Yeah.
So if you're going to ask them to be goofy, you got to be goofy yourself. and then the dancing that happens in the hotel room at the end of the movie, that wasn't in my script. And we did that in rehearsal. I had them dance like punk music, then like Rolling Stones to kind of represent William's character, Rhiannon by Fleetwood Mac to represent Julie's character. And then we got into a Glenn Miller song, and they started dancing like that style, arm in arm. And it was just really beautiful and kind of communicated what the movie was to me in certain levels. Just like these people trying to connect, these people trying to understand each other, and these people kind of like... out of the historical context they're supposed to be in. So listening to this 30s song in the 70s and finding this little moment of grace in this cheesy, bad hotel room just felt very poignant and accurate to me, to the what I was trying to say.
Okay,
right. Yeah.
So something I noticed in the film was the... many Casablanca references.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're watching the TV.
Yeah.
Dorothea says she wants to marry Bogart, and it's the song that ends the film.
Yeah.
It's the Casablanca song.
Yeah.
Is that a film that's particularly important to you?
Yeah, yeah.
At this time.
And my real mom used to always say, "In my next life, I'm going to marry Bogart."
Okay.
So that's that. I knew I wanted that in the movie, and I was thinking of different ways of exploring that. And my mom did love Bogart and did watch it, and you know, being it kind of explains the generation gap between me and my mom. She's Bogart, or As Time Goes By, the Rudy Valley song, and I'm Why Can't I Touch It by the Buzzcocks.
Okay.
And we're trying to get towards each other, but we're like in impossibly different places. And Casablanca took a strange influence in the movie where they watch it at the beginning, and it's the end of the movie where Rick and Ilsa are sort of both connecting and saying that we can't be together. And in a way, that's the story of my film. Rick and Elsa are like Dorothea and Jamie, are like this mother and son. They find a way to connect in the movie, but the movie's also saying that they'll never be as close as they wanted. They'll never have quite the relationship they thought they'd have. And there's something very bittersweet in that recognition. And so like the scene at the airport at the end of Casablanca really helped us understand the movie that we were making.
Okay, excellent. I didn't think of it that way, but no, I definitely will. okay, so a weird question then, based on the film. When you were that age, did you identify with the black flags or the art flags?
I like both a lot. I did get called an art flag for liking the Talking Heads, and I did have an orange Talking Heads 1977 shirt.
Okay.
So that's from a very lived experience. That whole thing of being like that was a real division in the punk scene.
Yeah.
There's like the artier side would get sort of beat up and called not real enough by the hardcore side.
Yeah. Okay. I definitely, I mean, I'm a huge Talking Heads fan, so that was quite funny watching the kid with the shirt. I have that shirt.
Yeah.
Something else that really connected with me in a weird way was the asphyxiation scene.
Yeah.
So I remember kids doing that, like, when I was at school 10 years ago, and it's weird that it's a weird thing that different generations have done.
Yeah.
It's just a weird thing that came to mind.
I mean, because I knew kids that did that. I knew a kid that ended up in the hospital for doing that, so that's kind of where that came from. But it's I find it such a 70s thing, but obviously people must have been doing it before. But to me, it kind of represents the boredom that happened in the 70s and the sort of lack of options, and even that kind of Jimmy Carter crisis of confidence speech and this lack of meaning. And why would you do something so... You're going to almost kill yourself or like potentially kill yourself or make yourself faint just for fun.
Mm.
You know, it kind of represents American suburban lack of options.
Okay. And you think that's something that's changed substantially?
No. But I feel like it's something that was kind of born in the 70s.
Okay.
We had enough luxury and privilege by then that we were investigating boredom before we're dealing with World War II. In the 50s and then the 60s is all the countercultural stuff. The first sort of real break from the American dream that was so active, though. And then that collapses, that narrative, that dream didn't work out, and where you left.
Mm.
And that's where I feel like you get into all this sort of meaninglessness that the 70s talked about a lot, late 70s. There was a lot of self-consciousness about sort of a lack of purpose.
Okay. So something I really admired about the film was... It's nostalgic and looking back, but without being too fond or looking back with too much anger. You kind of settle somewhere that feels really real. Is that important to you?
To not be too rose-lensed
looking back?
Yeah, I really hope so. I think it's pushing it in terms of its sentimentality or being rose-lensed. I definitely have a lot of fondness. I have just very bittersweet, elegiac feelings about that pre-digital life.
Yeah.
And my childhood, obviously, and Santa Barbara, and my mom. So it's very... And I wanted it to be full of emotion. I watched so many 40s movies and 30s movies, like in the kind of traditional Hollywood movies, or like Casablanca and I Have and Have Not, a lot. And they influence this movie in a funny way. So I feel like dangerously close to being sentimental, or I'm sure some people think I am, or like it's like too charming for its own good. But I kind of like embraced that, like those movies embraced that in a way that I really enjoyed. But to me, I'm using history as a way to help define characters.
Okay.
And I'm really interested in how our personal lives, our inner lives, our ideas we have about ourselves, and just like even our loves and our confusion is very much influenced by or defined by the moment in the history we're in. Like, I believe that.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested in beginners in this movie or sort of going back and forth between the micro personal history and the macro what's going on in American history.
Okay.
Like, channel, whatever you want to call
it. Okay, excellent. I think we're going to have to wrap up, but just one more question.
Yeah.
So we've mentioned Casablanca.
Yeah.
You've mentioned films from the 30s and 40s. I'm wondering what else influenced you for this film?
I loved... this to me is like my Fellini movie.
Cool, okay.
Like,
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Abacord, this is really similar to that. It's a portrait of a group of people in a particular town in a particular time. And I just adore that movie. And then Fellini's 8.5 also, like all the camera tracking movements. Hiroshima, Mon Amour, with the way that you have this one narrative of them in Hiroshima, but then you have these long backstories of her in France.
Yeah.
And the past is always interrupting the present. And then any Resnais movie, to me, the way he deals with time, and is very happy to disrupt time or go back and revisit a scene. I love non-linear time in film.
Okay, that's something that maybe struck me about this film, actually, was how I was surprised how that you'd see a shot just fleetingly and you'd revisit that same shot later in a different context. I thought that was really something quite interesting. And now that you've mentioned it, it's definitely very Rene-ish. So I'm really glad for that.
And there's another director, Yuzvan Szabó, Hungarian. He did this 1970 film called Love Film, which I adore. It's all about memory and growing up in Budapest during World War II and all that, which of course I have no relation to, but it's an example of how a person's concrete personal memories, unexplained, inserted into a film, can make that film very catchy to someone who hasn't lived anything like that experience. Just because you smell the realness in it, and it doesn't fit into neat storytelling formulas, and it's like a whole food in that way. And that's, I love that. That's really inspired. Then all the color smears that happen.
Yeah.
To me, that's very Chertilova's Daisies. You know,
I love that film.
I love that film. And just, again, there's a film that's not afraid to entertain.
Definitely. And incredibly
just,
playful.
And to just dance around.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have internalized enough of Godard's Brechtian rules that it feels very illegal to dance around and do color smears, you know? And so therefore all the more delicious to break those rules, you know.
That sounds very much in the spirit of Dorothea. Excellent. Mike, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
All right, Mike Mills there. He's one of the coolest people I've ever met.
I would get that impression from watching his films.
Really cool. Really, really nice to talk to. And when the interview was all finished and we stopped recording, he just kind of stood up and his publicist was there. And he just sort of just said to both of us, it's so weird that people are actually watching the film. I just can't believe it. It just feels very weird. Really nice thing to say.
Yeah.
So he was great. Right, so 20th Century Women then. For me, this is a really incredible film. A really nice story about a family. I just thought it's great, a really great vehicle for Annette Bening to make her quote-unquote comeback, because she hasn't exactly been away, but she's not been in the limelight or had this kind of vehicle for her.
I think the last time we've seen such big press was American Beauty.
Yeah, yeah. So, guys, what did you think of Annette Bening's performance here?
I thought she was incredible.
Yeah.
In this film. And it's also rare that you see a role for a woman of Annette Bening's age being the centre stage like that, and she was absolutely amazing in it. She's just so captivating to watch the whole way through.
Yeah.
Her face is so expressive. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought she's really terrific in this. But I think, it's kind of being sold as her film, but it's very much an ensemble piece.
Oh, yeah,
oh, for sure.
And the film is made in the moments of interaction between them. And it's a film full of just lovely moments and details that make up life and this life in 1979. And it's not hugely driven by its plot, and it's more driven by its characters and their interactions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is an arc that runs through it, and there's a story runs through it. But I don't. That's not. It's not like it's some big blockbuster where you need to know everything that's going on. You could almost dip in and out of it as well. It's sometimes like it's going through old photographs, and when you start watching the film, you feel like you know them already.
Mm-hmm.
It's so warm and enveloping, and you're so content to be in there with them and just watch these lives unfold around you.
Yeah, and yeah. I think there's no like major destructive thing or changing point that happens to any of these characters during the film. It's just a moment of their time in 1979 when the world was changing around them.
Yeah.
But they didn't necessarily hugely change within that time frame.
Yeah, and she mentions, because the film has multiple narrators,
mm-hmm.
and I think there's one point where Annette Bening's character, Dorothea, says something, talks about it being 1979, counterculture is just about to end, and Reagan's just about to start. So everyone's kind of at a crossroads. America is at a crossroads, but all the characters are as well.
Yeah.
But then it's not like a major change is about to happen in their lives.
Yeah.
It's just a slow... She's just... her future self is aware that at this point in their lives... they were slowly fading towards something different, something new.
Yeah, they didn't know the shift was happening.
But there's not an exact point where it's changed now. It just this is watching people fade into another part of their lives.
Mm. You've almost got two central characters with Annette Bening and Lucas Jade Zuman as well, as the little boy who's at the centre of it. So I suppose the narrative begins when Dorothea, which is the mother of Jamie, who's...
Mm-hmm.
Zuman's character asks the other women that are around him to try and guide him in life.
Yeah,
she kind of sort of says like, it's getting harder and harder to do this as a single parent, and harder to teach him everything I need to teach him about the world on my own. So I need your help.
Yeah, and because he is a teenager boy who doesn't want to spend his days with his mum anymore, but he does want to spend his days with young, cool women who can give him advice and give him books and take him to live music and go skateboarding and go to parties, and Annette Bening can kind of use them as a vehicle to almost not keep an eye on him, but learn about what he's like outside of her vision.
It's to get to know him, isn't it? She says that a few times, that she feels like she's sad that she can never know the boy that they know, and I think that's the thing that a lot of mums feel like when their children get to their teenage years. Your mum's gone from being the central role in your life, who knows everything about you, who you go to for everything, to the person you actually need to push away now to become the person that you need to be.
Yeah, she says,
"It's a hard transition.
You get to see him out in the world as a real person, and I never will."
Mm.
So this is the kind of like not her spies, but just she can sleep well knowing that there's someone that will get to see him and knows her as well, and kind of make sure he's okay and knows what he's doing. I think there's just something really about Dorothea that. There's sort of a warmth, a charm, and a wit to her, but she's also got this kind of acidity to her that she's also quite biting at times, and quite, not horrible, but a little bit sort of cynical when she speaks to people at times.
Yeah, I mean, there are throughout your thinking, oh, she for someone of her age at this time, she's quite liberal. Like, this is amazing what she's doing and how much freedom she lets her son have, and that she lets him be with these women and go out. I mean, she's not thrilled about it at points, but she still lets him do it because she's very much encouraging him to be his own person. And I think she is proud of things that he's done, even if they might be damaging at points too.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are moments, and it's brought up throughout, that she was a child of the Depression, and which is mentioned a number of times.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
Yeah. But then that kind of bitingness comes through, and there are moments where that kind of liberal freedom just kind of is stretched to its limit, and she thinks, right, like, as a mother figure, like, I'm not quite comfortable with that, or that's as far as this can go. And I think that was a really great introduction to her, because it could have been, oh, hippie mum, hippie cool mum,
or super mum,
or cool mum, like Gone Girl, like the idea of the cool girl, this would be the cool mum. But then it comes into those contradictions In the same vein that Captain Fantastic did as well, that you can try and teach your kids this stuff, but there are some times where you do need to kind of put your foot down as well.
And I think it's those contradictions and the fact that she's a really real watchable character and you really believe she's a real person. And I think it's so easy to tell that she's based on Mike Mills' own mother.
Yeah.
Because you can tell this character's been written by someone who really knew her and really admired her and really loved her. I think that's really nice to see as well.
Mm. And on that note, there's a great bit where Elle Fanning's character, Julie, says, it's all about
the mother. Yeah.
And it is, because my girlfriend is a very big fan of Miranda July, who is a writer and filmmaker who is married to Mike Mills, and she made Me and You and Everyone We Know, and she is a huge fan of Miranda July and has read all of her stuff and watched all her stuff. And she came out of 20th Century Women and said, it's amazing that he's made a film about his mum that's also about his wife. Yeah, so it's all about the mother.
So let's talk about some of the other characters then. So we mentioned Jamie there, who is, I guess, in a way, acts as the kind of sort of focal point for us.
Yeah, I think he's our gateway, isn't
he? Yeah, and he's pseudo Mike Mills in the film. He's kind of a younger version of him. I think it's we talked about young performers on the show before, child actors. I think he really handles his own in a film with big actors.
Yeah, and there are some bits where he's really got to stand his ground with some stuff that is, creates some very, very funny moments with how stoic he is in his delivery of it.
Yeah.
Against someone like Annette Bening, and and those moments are hilarious. And it's all down to him being completely driven, and that he knows that he knows what he needs to say, and he's just going to say it anyway, regardless of the fact that how old is he in this?
15, I think.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know how old he is in real life, but the character's age, it's the age where you don't quite know that what you're saying is, like, out of the ordinary, that grown-ups don't say this. Yeah. Like, you kind of enter in that you can say something like, that's what all grown-ups are talking about. Like, oh, no, actually, it's not in polite company.
There's one scene in particular that really stood out to me, and that's the menstruation scene at the dinner table. Yeah. I can't think of what else to call it.
Just a very public conversation about menstruation.
Yeah, and I think that's Greta Gerwig's Abby's best scene in the film as well.
Yeah, just trying to get people around the table to say the word menstruation.
And that kind of sums up the best about all the characters as well, because Abby's really fighting for people to say that comfortably in a kind of feminist vein, but then Dorothea doesn't want people to say it because you're at the dinner table, you shouldn't say those things.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the pinnacle of her contradiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
That she wants to be this liberal woman, but actually, like, part of her, she comes from a completely different generation. She has Jamie when she's 40, and she can't quite let go of some of the past hang-ups.
I think, but she does, she would love everything to be at a point that anyone can talk about anything, but also this is a dinner party with guests and children. And she's probably thinking, oh, there's a time and a place for this conversation.
Yeah, it's with all the girls.
It also has Billy Crudup's best line in this scene as well, which is, never have sex with just the vagina. You have to have sex with the whole woman.
Which leads us on to Billy Crudup's William, who is wonderful.
I loved him.
Yeah.
Very, very cool.
I think I might love him with all my heart.
And his wonderful moustache.
Yeah.
Yes.
So hard to pull off a moustache, and yet he does it with ease.
But it's not one of these trendy, shaped, waxy ones.
No.
Like, he's got bits of tufty beard around there. He's just there because he just wants it there, and he's living it like that. and he's really not trying. And he's got really untrendy, but therefore so, so cool glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He, I don't know if you've seen Almost Famous before, where he's in a band, and he looks exactly the same as he did there. So I like to think that when the band didn't work out, he became this sort of handyman, and he's the exact same character from Almost Famous.
Yeah, and you don't really... He's just kind of there when the film starts, and it takes you a while to really figure out who he is.
Yeah,
or why
he's there.
Yeah.
Very long time, because I thought for a while he was just the guy fixing up the house. Had no idea he was also living there, and it's kind of warm commune.
Because that's exactly what it feels like. Because for a while when I first saw this, it took me, I was like, I don't know what these relationships are. I don't know if Abigail's a family member and this and that. Mm-hmm. So it does take a while, because most films would have some exposition in the dialogue. But this one kind of it takes its time. It lets you know the characters, then find out the relationship just casually through the dialogue, which works really nicely. So what did you guys think of the narration in the film? Because I'm often not a fan of narration. I think most films don't need it. But you think it worked here?
Yeah, it did for me. I really loved it. I loved hearing from different perspectives, and it wasn't just Annette Bening's character. And she kind of kicked it off, and then you got other people dipping in along the way, and some not until the very end. But I loved hearing their stories, their points of view, and also that it was from way in the future.
I really liked this, and it made me feel like this was Mike Mills' film as well, because of watching Beginners. I can't remember it directly, where he says, this is what grass looks like, this is what trees look like, this is what a blah blah dress looks like, and that's Ewan McGregor in that. Mm-hmm. And I like that way of using the narrator to give you context and backstory, but it's not really expositional. It's just kind of telling you about the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than telling you about these characters, it's the narration's almost telling you about the world that they're in. I thought I really like it. It's so nice. It's almost like this lovely lecture for a bit, because the narration comes over old archive footage or stills. Yeah. And again, these don't come with context. It's not like we cut to these stills because someone's going through a photo album. They're just there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's great. And it brings this desynchronicity to the film, and it just kind of takes you out for a bit. But it's still within that world, and you've got these voices, and it's just really lovely to watch because they've all got lovely voices. And you can just listen to them talk about the state of the world, and I'd be fine with that.
And Mike Mills talked about how he's interested in real people and real people's lives, but I think the film, it doesn't look like a realist film. I think it's warmer than that. It's more colourful than real life.
Mm.
And I think he's done that on purpose, as it's supposed to be someone's memory.
Mm.
And you've talked about that with the narration taking place years in the future, that this is like feels like people looking back on their lives really warmly, because there's so many bright colours in this film.
Yeah, like especially when the car's driving becomes like a negative and the colours blur.
Yeah, the visual flourishes, things like that. Yeah, I think that's really a real nice touch that a lot of filmmakers would be scared to do when they're telling this kind of biographical film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, particularly if you're trying, it's almost like a magical realism at points, like this sun-drenched film look to it. And those moments do kind of take you out of the film, but they make you aware that this is a heightened reality.
Yeah.
This is the way that we view memories.
How long is the film set over? I can't remember. Is it just a summer or
Did
it not say?
It's never explicitly.
I don't think it's explicitly said. No,
because he's not at school. I got the impression. Yeah, it's
it feels like summer.
Yeah.
And the final character we haven't talked about yet is Elle Fanning's character, who
so cool.
But yeah,
she's
had an amazing year with the Neon Demon and now this.
Yeah.
She's become this kind of indie queen, indie princess.
And she's in The Beguiled, which is the new Sofia Coppola, and there's a new trailer for that yesterday, and she's in that, and that looks really cool as well.
Yeah, she's making excellent career choices, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
She's not just doing the big franchise stuff that a lot of young actresses would do.
Mm.
I just love the whole idea of her sneaking into his bed, but then refusing to have sex with him.
Yeah.
I loved as well that she is obviously really cool in this whole scene, but you're also showing that actually she is quite like damaged as well.
Yes,
her behaviour that she's portraying isn't actually kind of safe behaviour for her mental health or the people around her, but also that she's not so damaged she's beyond repair. This is a phase of her life she's going through where things are difficult for her and she doesn't know how to express herself, but that she's going to get past that.
And okay, let's touch on Abby a bit more then. So this is Greta Gerwig, who, like Elle Fanning, I guess, has this kind of niche of this sort of indie hipster film filmography going on for her. Jack, you're a big Greta Gerwig fan, aren't you?
I certainly am. I love Greta Gerwig so much. She's brilliant in
and
everything.
How was she in this?
She was superb. And her hair is amazing in this cropped red hair. And, I mean, I don't want to say that I've fallen in love with two characters from the same film, but when she was at art school, she saw The Man Who Fell to Earth and cut her hair and dyed it red. Oh no. Oh, she's cool. She's so cool. She's impossibly cool. Yeah, I think she's great in this. And there's a really lovely bit where she starts this new photo project where she's going to make this self-portrait without the self, and she takes photos of everything that she owns.
I was like, why haven't I thought of something like that?
And then she's like quite proud of it, and she takes it to William, Billy Crudup's character, and shows it to him, and he just says, "It's really sad," which I thought. But like, you know, like because he's very emotional, he's very raw, and he wears his heart on his sleeve, and he means that in the nicest way. And it leaves a really lovely sex scene between them, where she asks him to pretend to be a photographer. It's very, very lovely.
And there's so many moments that are both laugh out loud and really heartwarming, like that sex scene. There's a few moments where you're just like, I cannot believe you're doing this.
Yeah.
And then,
should I be laughing at this? Or is this really sad?
Yeah.
I loved her dancing as well.
Yeah.
That's amazing dancing.
You can just watch her dance in anything.
Also, Greta Gerwig's a trained ballerina as well. Yeah. And she's like, with all her spiky movements, she must have been really trying hard.
Trying hard to do bad dancing. I would like to point out that a few weeks ago, Sam purchased a pink Talking Heads t-shirt with green writing on. And I thought, oh, that's a pretty cool t-shirt. Sam's cool. Sam's a cool guy now. I mean, he likes the Talking Heads, and he's got the t-shirt to prove it. And then I watched this film and found out Sam's not as cool as I thought.
I saw this film and thought, I'm just going to buy that t-shirt and not tell anyone.
Yeah, so he had the advantage of seeing this a month ago and had a month of people thinking, oh, he's cool. And now it's all crumbled.
It's all gone. Yeah. I was hoping this film wouldn't get released in the UK. Yeah. Just so I could pull off.
So you stole your fashion choices from a 15-year-old kid.
Yeah. I stole it from Mike Mills.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we finish, just like to thank CSR for letting us use their studio once again. And on Curzon Home Cinema this week, I would like to recommend the collection of the 2017 BAFTA Shorts, because the BAFTAs are taking place this Sunday and all the nominees for Best Short Film are available on Curzon Home Cinema now. Jake, what's your recommendation?
My recommendation is, just because I mentioned The Beguiled earlier in the show, there is Melancholia on there, which has got Kirsten Dunst in a Cannes Award winning performance for Lars von Trier, and she appears in The Beguiled, teaming up with Sofia Coppola again after Marie Antoinette and Virgin Suicides. So go and check that out if you want some really, really, really great Kirsten Dunst in your life.
Excellent. And Jenna?
I'm going to recommend Sunita, which is about an Afghan refugee in Iran who has tried to be forced into an arranged marriage, but instead has become a rapper. And it follows her. And I haven't actually seen it myself. I'm watching it this week and I'm really excited about it. So I want people to talk to you about it.
Excellent. And we've also got a little bonus treat for you, because on Sunday we'll be releasing a special mini episode, which Jake's going to tell you about now.
So I am speaking to Grant Goshick, who is an academic focusing on post-war, mid-20th century American literature. And he has studied all of August Wilson's plays and the entire Pittsburgh cycle, with a particular focus on Fences, which is coming out with Denzel Washington and Viola Davis. And it's a remarkable film. And I think it's just going to be really interesting to sit down with someone perhaps slightly out of the film world who can give us a bit more background on Wilson, the Pittsburgh cycle, Fences, the variations between Fences the play and Fences the film, how successful it is at that, and just to give us a bit more background on the film, really.
Great, so that's available on Sunday, and it will be available in the same places that the podcast is available.
Yeah.
And also a quick reminder that we do have a competition this week, so that is a chance to win a vinyl copy of 20th Century Women's soundtrack, which we didn't get a chance to talk about, but I think we all really loved it.
Oh, yeah, oh, certainly. Yeah. It's got the Talking Heads in.
I know, the best band of all time. A question will be appearing on our various social media platforms at some point today. The answer to that question we have said in the show at some point, so make sure you are listening intently. Okay, so that's goodbye from Jake.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Jenna.
Bye.
Goodbye from me, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.